Why, they sprung up everywhere. They'd even spring up in the mail. My gracious, what a discovery that was, that this thing could be done in the mail. And then they all began to write the New York office of the terrible troubles they were having, these awful problems. And then pretty soon they had the clubhouse problem, and they had the poker problem. And what were those boys and girls doing in the clubhouse besides staying sober problem? They had the organization problem, and we had the missionary problem all over again. And we had the big money problem all over again. And we had problems of prestige, and oh, dear, it was nothing but problems. And I used to just sit in that desk at New York and say, my God, are we going to present all of America, each with a group of alcoholics who does not wish to stay sober? What a present that would be. Well, those were the days of our adolescence. Or with the advent of that Saturday Post piece, we had passed out of the pioneering time. We had passed through our infancy. And this was that exciting, fearsome period of adolescence. And on its anvil, the AA tradition was hammered out. Those principles of group relations, our relations one with the other, one group with the other, our relations with the world outside. And we commenced to make a lot of very marvelous and singular discoveries about ourselves. We found that this society of ours was destined to be quite unlike any other human form of society. Here was a society where, in some respects, the welfare of the whole had to be paramount to that of any individual. God knows it was important for the individual to survive, but if this group and this movement couldn't survive, there wouldn't be much recovery for anybody, especially the million yet to come. We also made another discovery, that this society didn't run on permanent inspired leadership like me. And a lot of other inspired ones you had since, you know. No, sir. We began to talk about something called the group conscience. I remember when that word first began to be used. I don't know who coined it. And the old-timers would look at me and say, what the hell do they mean, the group conscience? That group of mine ain't got any conscience. After all the good I done to them, look what they done to me. They slit my throat and tossed me out. What do you mean, the group conscience? Why, those galoots, they're the most ungrateful bunch. But still, we learned that the group conscience, once it was informed, once people had begun to practice the steps in their lives, that the conscience of this group could be a wiser thing respecting its own survival than that of any inspired leader. How I well remember their instructing me for the first time in that principle, that the group could be wiser than the individual. And what a critical decision it was, too. After this thing had been going on about 3 years, we were still awful hard up, as you know. Rockefeller hadn't coughed up. Lois was still in that goddamn store. And one day I'm up at old Charlie Towns, who ran the drunk emporium where old Doc Silkworth was. And old Charlie, he'd been kind of skeptical about this drunk fixing business, but all of a sudden he'd caught fire. So he called me into his office and he said, look here, Bill, I'm a business guy, but he said, unlike some of these drunk tank proprietors, I'm a man with a heart. I guess I am. And he said, it looks to me like a lot of these drunks are getting well, and they're going back to work, and they, most of them are bright, and they make good money, and you're starving to death. And right, I said, you bet your life. That's just right. I'm starving to death, and they're getting along. One of those days, I felt sorry for myself. Well, he said, Bill, ain't it a fact that you had that funny spiritual experience in here in one of them front rooms? And yeah, I said, that's fine. He said, ain't it a fact that Dr. Silkworth was the guy who introduced the idea of sickness into this society of yours and that that's a cornerstone principle today? Yeah, that's right. Well, he said, didn't we let you come back here and visit drunks in the early days and incur the ridicule of every doctor around New York City? I said, yeah, that's fine. Well, he said, look, Bill, he said, why shouldn't you weed out of this? Well, I said, I've often wondered. I've tried to, but I can't yet. Well, he said, here, I'm going to make an offer. He said, now look here, during 1929, this drunk tank used to make a lot of dough. That was the day of the stricken Wall Street stockbrokers. We used to make several thousand when this hospital was full. Now, he said, we've been having kind of hard going, and it's about break even. But he said, mark me, young guy, someday this movement of yours is going to fill Madison Square Garden, and I really believe it. Now, he said, since the movement started right in here, at least in part, why shouldn't I give you an office here? Why shouldn't I give you a drawing account in this place? And he said, I'll go further. I'll give you a third interest in the place. If you'll just come in here and make your headquarters in there. He said, there isn't anything unethical about that. You could join my staff as a lay therapist, as indeed you are. You've done more for drunks already than anybody I know anything about. I'll guarantee not to advertise you unethically. Why don't you do it? Well, I don't mind saying that like many AAs since, I was tempted. There wasn't anything unethical about it. It was quite all right. So excitedly I ran home, was cooking supper for a lot of them drunks we were boarding for nothing after a hard day in that damn department store. And I said, well, Mama, we're going to eat. Going to go to work for old Charlie, have some kind of a head and tail of this thing, a little drawing account. If we fill up Charlie's drunk tank, why, we might even get $1,000 a month caught up there someday. Well, kind of sounded good to her. She was getting tired. The next night, we had a meeting, a little AA meeting. Wasn't even called an AA meeting then. We had to coin the name down the front parlor. By this time, I had got a wonderful rationalization. You know, we drunks are great on this phony rationalization business. And sad to relate, there is no nonsense which cannot be made out of even the Bible itself. And I've got this biblical reason for going to work for Charlie Town. And in this case, it certainly was a honey. The laborer is worthy of his hire. So I tell my drunk friends the wonderful story of how, won't they be so glad to know that I'm going to be able to eat and Lois can come in out of that department store. We can hold up our heads like other folks. How nice it would be to have a headquarters up there. How good old Charlie and Dr. Silkworth have been to us. And I can just see the faces of those drunks fall. They knew we were having a damn hard time. They really hated to say anything to me. But finally one of them spoke up. And I since realized that he was speaking for the conscience of that group. And what did he say to me? He said, but Bill, if you hire out to Charlie, you make yourself a professional doing therapeutic work. Bill, don't you realize that if you tie this thing to that one hospital, that no other hospital will have anything to do with it? And Bill, don't you realize this thing works because we ain't got any professional guy? And finally he said to me, Bill, aren't you the fellow who has so often sat in this meeting and told us that sometimes the good is not good enough? Sometimes the good is the enemy of the best. So what Charlie says is ethical. What he offers is ethical. But Bill, it isn't good enough. And then he looked at me and he said, Bill, you can't do this thing to us. And so spoke the group conscience to me. And I suddenly realized that it was far wiser than I. And fortunately, oh, how very fortunately for this movement, I bowed to the group conscience and I obeyed. And from that day to this, I have realized that I am the pupil of this movement and not its teacher. Well, membership, we put that rule in reverse today. Any guy who's a member of AA who says he is, can't keep him out. I used to think I could run this whole movement, and now the AA tradition guarantees every group to run its business the way it wants to, as long as it doesn't interfere with surrounding groups. Years ago, we had that foundation chartered to research and educate and do everything for drunks every place all the time. No more. We can't endorse other enterprises. Other enterprises can't use our name and raise money and get publicity out of the AA name. It took us years to learn that. We know that AA can devote itself to only one purpose, and that's to carry the message to that other alcoholic. And from the very beginning, as by some deep instinct, we knew that this movement could never quarrel about the kind of things that society outside quarrels about. We knew that if we ever quarreled about religion here, if we ever quarreled about politics, if we ever permitted this society as a movement to become rich, we would be done. So in AA, we squabble about, well, how are you going to fix the clubhouse? How are you going to do the most good for drunks? Sometimes who slept with who? All that kind of thing. We don't quarrel about politics and religion and reform. No, no, no. We know we can't. So came our non-controversy tradition. And all this time, we found that our usual traditional American attitude about public relations was being put right in reverse. In this beloved land of ours, we love to have our public heroes. We erect great monuments to great people. Even our advertising is run on personal ballyhoos. But we of AA have discovered over the years that is not for us. And we began to say, let us place principles before people. Let us remain anonymous at the public level. And over the years, we've discovered that anonymity is not only a protection for the people coming in, it has a deep spiritual significance. It betokens our individual and our group humility. The willing to put this thing ahead of our own welfare. And we have also latterly learned that it is the greatest protection against exploitation that this society can ever have, anonymity at the public level. And so, dear people, in these exciting years of adolescence, we have developed a tradition, which indeed is no body of law. There are no rules or regulations. But we have learned that in a tradition, confirmed in the heart of each one of us, and in our experience of AA, in such a tradition there is immense containing power. And we are now becoming confident that in the application of that tradition in our daily AA lives, that we have a force of incomparable power which can bind this movement together, which may keep us proof against the forces of destruction that rend other societies of men apart. The world around us is breaking into pieces. Society is fissioning, splitting up into bits. As AA grows, we are getting more and more and more unified. I don't mean that we are complacent. I think we should be prudent. We must realize that someday we may have to face this religious issue, that political issue, that reform issue. We shall have great problems that will cut across this movement. Of course we shall. All societies of men have those problems. And all societies of men today are succumbing to those problems. But in 1950, only last summer in Cleveland, 7,000 of us there concluded that the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous is a platform on which we dare commit this movement to its future. And there in Cleveland at 1950, we took our destiny by the hand and declared that this movement had grown up. So those are the first two of the legacies which we old-timers are leaving you. A legacy of recovery by the 12 steps, and a legacy of unity by application of the AA tradition. Now this concludes the first two sections of this yarn I'm spinning, and I suggest that we now have a 5-minute intermission. Don't go running out, because you can never get these drunks back to get to yakking out there. But stretch yourselves a little bit, and then I'll pour on the last installment a little faster. So now we have finished that exciting, pleasant, and very dramatic journey through our beginning, through the days of our adolescence. And now you and I stand looking ahead together along the broad highway that is AA. Next to our own recoveries, it is, of course, the dearest wish of each of us that this society remain in unity and in the greatest possible effectiveness in the cause of the million who don't yet know, for so long as it shall be needed. Since the very beginning, there has been a principle in operation which sometimes we overlook, and it is my prime purpose in coming here to elevate that principle so that it stands alongside of our recovery principle and our principle of tradition. For AA is something more than just a belief in the 12 principles of recovery. AA is something a great deal more than a belief in the traditions. If AA is anything, Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of action. When the drunk takes a look at those 12 steps, if he would recover, he has to do something about them. If we have a body of tradition and would remain in unity and usefulness, each individual and each group, each area, and AA as a whole has to do something about these things. So AA is a program of action. And anything which enables AA to act, to function, we are coming to call a service. Therefore, AA consists of recovery. It consists of tradition. But it also consists of activity, and many of those activities take the form of services. As I just said, a service is anything that legitimately enables AA to function and to grow and to propagate itself. For example, when the first doctor told me what alcoholism was, he performed a great service for this movement, although he himself is not a member. When he encouraged me to come and work in his hospital, he performed a great service. When he sobered me up, he rendered me the service of hospitalization. For AA, you must remember, is no monopoly of we alcoholics. We draw from the principles of religion. We draw upon the principles of medicine. Together we can do what we could not do separately. I suppose one of the very earliest services performed for AA, and it is still the biggest service that is performed in a money sense, and I don't know, but in a real sense, when Lois Wilson and Annie Smith brewed those first pots of coffee and baked those cakes for the drunks out in the living room, those women were doing something that helped AA to function. I was guest tonight, among many others, at a dinner given by a friend and his wife. That was a service that greased the wheels of progress, that helped AA function. So anything legitimate that helps us to function, which doesn't violate our tradition, is a service. Now today you will hear a cry which rings all throughout AA, and I hope it never stops ringing. People say, let's keep AA simple. Beware of organization, the least possible organization. But I draw your attention that since the beginning we found that too much simplicity could presently result in great complications. When those meetings got too big for parlors, and we had to move out into halls, AA got a little bit more complicated. It wasn't quite so simple. In the parlors, there weren't any founders, there weren't any officers, there wasn't any money. It was utterly simple. But supposing AA had been in parlors ever since, and no services had been provided. Well, we moved out of parlors into halls. Then we discovered, sometimes to our pious indignation, that landlords wanted rent for places to sit down in. So that brought in the subject of money. And then somebody had to pass the hat. And after a while, the fellow informally passed the hat, and the old-timer stuck the money in his pocket and handed it to the landlord. He gave way to a treasurer, which your group probably elects. Or if it's a club, you elect it. And then there got to be something called a secretary. Sometimes a hell of a row, was the girl with the blue hair or the girl with the green hair, but at any rate, you got yourself a secretary. And she'd answer the phone, maybe, and write some letters down, get some books. By and by, your group or your club, it has a chairman, looks after arrangements. Maybe visits the local newspaper and gets in contact with the doctors. In other words, we began to develop a class of service people who did not govern AA and who never will, because it is certainly no blasphemy to say that even God couldn't govern a bunch of drunks. But the drunks will and must name people to perform chores, so that the group can function. Is that not obvious? And we have been really doing this since the beginning. True enough, those service jobs, even the volunteer ones, are thankless ones. But they get done. Well, when you get a lot of groups in an area, what happens? Got to have a little head or tail to it. The original group can't be permitted to run everything. You don't like that. So by and by, each one of your groups names a representative, and you have some kind of a central service or intergroup association. Finally, you probably hire a little office and put in a phone and hire one guy or a gal or even two or three of them in big places. So several hundred or several thousand drunks in an area will have actually a paid employee or two. Well, when that happens, there's an awful lot of grinding of the wheels and a hell of a commotion. Great cries of professionalism go up. The person that's hired, you think they're AA professionals. Years ago, we commenced to thrash all that up. I remember the first time we had this AA professionalism business come up. We'd started a little club up there in New York, first AA clubhouse in the world. A little bit of a place. Volunteers came in and they scrubbed and they painted, and gals hung up little chintz curtains, and gee, it was clubby, you know. Everything went along fine for a while. The volunteers did everything, except for the landlord, of course, who had to be paid. We couldn't mix any money with this. Well, after a while, the volunteer folks, they kind of bogged down a little. The floor didn't get swept, and there were drunks laying around the place, much too drunk, and it was even said that other people were laying around the place. It was obvious we had to have somebody there all the time. So we had in mind a good old guy that we just got out of one of the insane asylums. We got over our jitters about that. He was an ex-fireman, New York City Fire Department. Old Tom Mulhall had been around in his day. So he said, why, now, it would be just wonderful to get old Tom to come over here at the club and live. He could kind of look after things, you know. So we approached old Tom and we said, Tom, how would you like to come over to the clubhouse? We'll give you a free room over there, Tom. Tom says, what's the angle? What's the angle? Well, Tom, we'd like to have you move over to the clubhouse. If we gave you a room and you were right there on the spot, you could kind of look after things a little. He said, what do you mean look after things? Well, we said the floor got to be swept every day here, and if the volunteers ain't around, you got to answer the telephone. And naturally, in the wintertime, you'd fire the furnace. Tom says, 7 days a week for all this? Yeah. Then, Tom, you drunks get too drunk. You know, you have to lead them outside. Well, Tom says, ain't you going to pay me nothing? Oh, no, we said, you couldn't make money out of Alcoholics Anonymous, Tom. Oh, God, no. Money will ruin this thing, Tom. Tom looked at us with a very fishy eye, and he said, I think you guys has got a hell of a nerve. I think you've got a hell of a nerve. What you guys really want is a janitor, is that right? He says, what in hell has that got to do with that 12th step? He said, I think you guys have got a big nerve. You all come in here and you use this clubhouse and you can't or you won't sweep it out and you won't tend to the furnace and you won't get down here and answer this phone. So you want me to come in and be a janitor for you for nothing, to do that which you want or can't do yourself while you go out and make good living, huh? Oh, we said, but Tom, you got a pension from the fire department. He says, what's that got to do with it? He says, what you want is a janitor, and if I'm coming in there to be a janitor, you're going to pay me for being a janitor. I do me 12-step work. You ain't paying me nothing for that, but you're going to pay me for being a janitor, or I don't come, see? Well, it took us years and years and years to learn that that old boy was absolutely right. In other words, here were we who were out making good livings, drawing good pay as a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous, and here were we trying to coerce this old gent into contributing about $100 a month worth of labor to that club when most of us weren't giving the club $5. It wasn't even Christian. Why did we take the attitude? One, because we were afraid of professionalism. And two, because we had made the unhappy discovery that though drunks are individually generous, collectively people, they're tight as the bark on a tree. And we actually beat that poor old guy down to half price to get him in there, too. Well, little by little, this society has learned that when it needs to hire a janitor, when it needs to hire a secretary, and pardon me, when it needs to hire an author, it ought to pay up. And that doesn't make an author or a janitor or a secretary a professional AA, too, if they got a legitimate job to do over and above that 12-step. One thing we learned to do, you cannot sell that 12-step for money. But if we're going to ask somebody to work full-time for this society, we ought to pay them, and we ought to pay them, if our group is able to pay them, the going commercial rate. Otherwise, we're forcing a money contribution out of those people that we wouldn't make ourselves. So the line got drawn on this professionalism, and that's where it now stands. We don't say work cheap for AA. If we got the money, we'll pay you like we would any non-alcoholic we'd have to hire. It's taken years to evolve that, but thank God it's now here. And thank heaven our bills of that kind are very small. And thank heaven there aren't even a handful in the AA who are paid for these special services. And the number never can be very large. Well, to continue. Then the club found that it had to have a committee or a board to run it. It found, as a club, it found it had to have a janitor. The office found it had to have a secretary. The area found that it had to name representatives to get together to choose a committee to look after its office. And those things represented services that enable this society to function and to grow, without which it just simply couldn't function and grow. In fact, it could fall into decay and into confusion. Too much simplicity would soon make for too much complication. Now, I think we all ought to distinguish between any effort to organize the AA movement and an effort to organize these simple services so they'll stand up and work. You cannot organize a bunch of drunks. Alcoholics Anonymous can never have a government. Why? Because drunks simply won't be governed by people. If anything characterizes us, it has been a lifelong history of disobedience to people, to governments, to principles, to everything. Well, now when we get into AA, we become obedient, all right. But we don't become obedient to our fellow AA, we become obedient to God. We become obedient to a principle. I'll say this, that if we have 100 AAs 3 years ago who are breaking their anonymity every day of the week, and that list has now come down to only a half a dozen, and you got a society with 100,000 screwball egocentrics in it, and only six of them are breaking their anonymity publicly as a regular thing, I say that that's a tremendous amount of obedience. But it's not obedience to a people, it's obedience to a principle. So this society does have the theological virtue of obedience, but happily it is not necessary for us ever to be obedient to a government. Therefore, AA will never be organized in a governmental sense, but we do have to organize these services, these clubs, these offices. A book doesn't get published just by accident. Somebody has to look at it. So you see, my dear friends, all throughout our history, from the coffee and cake days up, we have had to construct services. People have had to do special jobs to help us to function. And my purpose is to make this idea of services and those services respectable, and to get us to feel collectively responsible to see that they go on, because if they don't, AA won't go on in its present form. And the million who don't know will suffer acutely. Now, years ago, anticipating a need, Dr. Bob and I realized that this movement would surely need a few services for the benefit of the whole. In other words, we knew that this movement would need a standard literature, hence the terrific effort to produce that book, our first great instrument of service to the whole of AA. As we told you, we constructed a committee of friends called the Alcoholic Foundation, along with some of us drunk. As I explained last night, by and by, this book, which a few of us got together and financed and produced, was turned over to that board of trustees who hold that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in trust for you, the members of AA. They own it. It is your book, held by them in trust. An instrument for the whole movement. Well, it is a question of holding the book. They have to get it printed. 25,000 copies a year. Somebody has to look at it. Well, in the very early days of AA, when the Saturday Post article came along, our little office of the first year or two was entirely supported by the sales of that book. Not me, just a gal and a rent. Then later, when that Post article came on, we had thousands of inquiries pour in there. The book sales wouldn't hire us girls enough to answer those frantic letters. So we came out to the groups of that day in 1941 and said, look, shall we throw all these pleas into the wastebasket? Or will you, the members of AA, come and help us answer these letters? Refer them to the nearest group. Help them start groups if they in the mail if they're near no one else. Supply them with the literature. Will you voluntarily contribute to this foundation so that they can maintain this office in which that job can be done? So in 1941, just as a rough measuring stick, we said to this movement, if you people will give us $1 apiece a year down here at the foundation, we will see that all of these inquiries are answered. Meanwhile, the book can pay off its debt, and maybe accumulate a little reserve fund. So that was the second step in the evolution. And the foundation had two kinds of money, book money and your money, which could only be spent on the office. Well, next thing you know, right after that post article, back came all these group problems. What do we do about this? What do we do about that? From all over the world. So then we began to be retailers of experience. From the older group, we could say to the newer groups, well, their experience tells us this. So we help propagate the movement and help organize new groups at a distance. A work which is not going on so much on this side of the water, because there's so many of you. One now takes fire from the other. But all over the world, we're still doing that. If you go to London, England, or Oslo, Norway, or Durban, South Africa, or to that northernmost group in Alaska, they'll tell you what the Alcoholic Foundation means to them. It is life. It is their only contact with this world that you and I know so well. So the office took on another function. Well, then pretty soon, the problem arose. Hasn't this society got to have some kind of a public relations policy? I tell you how we got thinking about that, it's a good yarn. There was an AA who caught fire by reading the book in the mail. We started to correspond with him. He was down near Jacksonville, Florida. And he was one of those super promoters. I guess he was a couple supers above me, because all of a sudden he was on the Jacksonville radio with a curious mixture of AA and some shouting brand of religion. I don't know which one. And sure enough, he got in a few inquiries into Jacksonville over that little station, and a group starts in Jacksonville. So he beats on his chest, and all of a sudden he writes a letter up to the foundation office, and he said, I got a contract with the Gulf Life Insurance Company. They're going to hire me as a broadcaster. They're going to put me on an all-American hookup, about 100 stations, to give my 13 lectures on Alcoholics Anonymous. And here is a script. My God, I looked at the scripts and they stunk. They were terrible. Well, then the issue arose, could any AA member appoint himself to stand up on the national hookworker, national radio network, to represent all of us by just appointing himself to do the job? And this damn script stunk. What could we do about it? So I write him a nice diplomatic letter, and I say, well, of course it's wonderful your talk started the group in Jacksonville, but I don't think the drunks around through the country would like that. Frankly, some of it isn't on the AA party line. Why, I wouldn't even dare take the responsibility you're taking. You're going to break your anonymity, you tell me. You've got to tell that this is your message to the drunks of America. Besides, you're going to get paid for this job by the Gulf Life Insurance Company. And your scripts aren't really straight AA, frankly. Why don't you consult with our board of trustees and maybe we can revamp this thing and maybe get it authorized? Well, he was a super promoter, you know, in his own right. So he writes me a very crusty letter in which he said, to hell with you, Mr. Wilson, and the board of trustees. Who do you think you are? This is America. I got to write a free speech, says he. All right, that brought us right square up with the issue. Did this movement have any control, whatever, about what was said about it? Could any AA nominate himself to represent us all in a matter as vital as that? Which would affect the lives of hundreds and maybe thousands of people? Well, so I wrote him back a letter, and I said, like Voltaire, I would be the first, my dear friend, to defend your right of freedom of speech. But if I'm going to defend your right to speak freely, I will see to it that the several thousand AAs in this country speak their mind very freely on this broadcast of yours, if you put it on. And I will suggest to them that they write letters to your sponsor, the Gulf Life Insurance Company and the Mutual Broadcasting Company, telling them just what they think about that lousy script of yours. You're still at liberty to put it on, but if you do, look out for this free speech from these drunks. And when about 3,000 of them get talking loud, you'll really hear it. Well, we didn't have any broadcasts from down there. But that raised a problem. Was anybody going to be appointed to look after such matters? So, years ago, I wrote the groups of that time and said, will you entrust these trustees of the foundation with power to overlook our public relations? Local public relations, any group can do anything it likes. But when we got a piece in Saturday Post, or a national broadcast, or a motion picture, won't you name this board of trustees to look after these things through your office here in New York? And you wrote in and you gave us control of your public relations. I don't mean a legal control, but a tradition has grown up that AAs, if they're going to do a job like that, come to us and be sure that it's regular. So now, by now, the Board of Trustees has come into control of your book. It's come into control of your propagation machinery. It's come into control of your pamphlet literature. It controls the clearing of thousands of inquiries every year, not only from drunks, but from God knows how many people. Last year, that office answered 78,000 letters. That's a lot of mail. So is AA going to answer its mail? Well, I guess it is. Well, then, other services developed up there. It began to be obvious that the foreign groups had to have translations of all our pamphlet literature, maybe finally of our book. The book needed to be done in Oslo, Norway. It needed to be done in England. They couldn't buy books here. Lois and I went abroad last summer to arrange that. Now, this matter of public relations is terrifically important. Before I leave that subject, let me tell you two more stories. Recently, on the newsstand here, you could buy a magazine called Fortune, kind of a flossy dollar businessman's magazine. Some of you picked that up, and you saw in it one of the best articles on Alcoholics Anonymous ever printed. And you probably said, well, that's a nice piece. You didn't know, of course, that our office spent hours and hours and hours with the guy who wrote that piece. You didn't know the guy himself was the vice president of Fortune and a damn good AA, but that he had to come over to our office to get background and to get the idea on the tradition and all the stuff that's in that piece. You didn't know we spent some of your money long-distance calls to his home in Florida, that some of the Fortune staff were over and we had a conference about it. That's why it was a good piece. Because somebody was looking after these things for you. You see, a lot of these services have been unknown, have been unseen to you. AA has a good public relations record, sure, because we mind our own business. But also, because somebody all these years have been looking after these things for you. Let me give you one more example. Of course, AAs are every place. One of them happens to be a producer in the Paramount Company. Another producer in the company started to produce a picture about Alcoholics Anonymous. He had a script written. It was called Mr. and Mrs. Anonymous. The AA got a hold of it and he shipped it down to New York screaming. He said, this is terrible. It misrepresents AA. Which, in its original version, it did. From our point of view, it was really a stinkeroo. You know, boy meets girl in AA, they're both drunks, but instead of AA curing them, love cured them. They had a lot of love in AA, but never knew it to cure a drink. So that wasn't a very accurate representation. Of course, to pass the Hayes office, the picture came out all right because boy loved girl so much in AA. I don't know whether it was in the club room or not. Boy loved girl so much that the boy finally went back to his wife and it all ended happily ever after. You know, that isn't just the kind of a picture that would do AA a hell of a lot of good. It wasn't awful, but it from our point of view, it just stopped. Well, now that's what started a year ago in Holland. You people wouldn't know that we had on the job one of the best movie agents in New York, and she did the work free because she had a father who died of alcoholism, and one of her best friends sobered up in AA. So we had her services, one of the shrewdest agents in New York, to go to work on that thing. We had an immense amount of correspondence with the Paramount Company. We had AA actors and other AAs in Hollywood working over that situation. We got the Hayes office into it. We had a lawyer even threaten lawsuit on it. Incidentally, if there are any newspaper reporters here, I wish they wouldn't feel that I'm criticizing the Paramount Company or report this particular part of the thing. I'm trying to illustrate a point. And little by little, the Paramount people came around to our point of view and whittled the thing down and took the title off it, Mr. and Mrs. Anonymous, so that when you see that picture, you say, well, it ain't too bad. But if you'd seen it in its original form, you'd have jumped right over the theater and said, who foisted this on us? Now, that is the kind of work that's been going down there for years and years and years. A few years back, some A's in New York started to put out a newspaper called The Grapevine. The foundation didn't have anything to do with it. I didn't have anything to do about it. All on its own steam, it got national circulation. So about 5 years back, having seen the thing made good, I wrote and asked the groups, do you wish to make this your principal journal of Alcoholics Anonymous? Almost unanimously, you wrote back and you said yes. So therefore, the Grapevine was attached to the foundation. So there is your principal mirror of AA thought, which is all the time broadening its usefulness and its pages and opening them up to AAs in all parts of the world. On its magic carpet, we can fly all over the AA landscape, look over each other's shoulders every morning. Now, those services have directly and indirectly accounted for about a half of the size of Alcoholics Anonymous and a great deal of unity. Is it very obvious, is it not obvious that those things should go on? And don't you see that if they break down someday because they're not tended to or because they're not supported, that the million who don't know may suffer? Supposing that a breakdown took place there and those services failed and it got into the world press something has gone wrong at AA headquarters. What do you think would happen in foreign lands? Well, I'll tell you. I was in England last summer. Those Britishers are just where we were 10 or 12 years ago. Sure, they know AA works over the water. But they still wonder if it isn't Yankee gadget. Yes, we've got a little intergroup in London, 200-300 members around there. But still, only 3 or 4 doctors in Great Britain know anything about AA. The press won't print anything about AA. Only the Financial Chronicle in London run a piece about AA up the last summer. I don't know why the Financial Chronicle, some British twist of some sort. The doctors don't know anything about it. The Church of England don't care a hoot. Okay, supposing that something gets into the world press to the effect that AA has gone sour at the top over here. Don't you think all the drunks are going to turn their faces to the wall and go on suffering or die? Don't you think the newspapers will continue to clam up? Don't you think the doctors will say it's a Yankee fan? Don't you think the clergymen will all be looking the other way? Will that stop AA abroad? No. But it might slow it up for a year. It might slow it up 5 years. It might slow it up 10 years. So I ask each of you seated here tonight, what if Alcoholics Anonymous had been 5 years too late for you? So it is by such illustration that I urge that these services that Dr. Bob and our friends created for you years ago in New York, services for the benefit of the whole that cannot be done separately or regionally, that these things go on. That you now come to understand what they are, what they mean, what they cost. Fortunately, it's very small business. If every drunk in the movement sent us 75 cents apiece a year, we'd be on Easy Street. Very small business, but very important. About 4 years ago, 5 years ago, a few of us began to realize that these services were still in the hands of a very few people, that they were very remote from you, that they were still the function of Dr. Bob and me and our friend. And when it developed that Dr. Bob had cancer, I was horrified to realize that he and I were the principal links between that board of trustees who looks after these things and you. And that one of those links was going to go out after a while. And then I would be the only remaining link. And then when I went out or eloped with a cook or something, then what would happen? In other words, if that happens, the first time those fellows made a mistake, the first time this movement had a problem too hot for those trustees to handle, you people would wake up and find your business in the hands of strangers. And you would say of Smith and me, why did they leave things this way? Why didn't they give us a chance to look after our own business? Why didn't they build some links between this board of trustees and us? And those would have been very good questions. So we realized that the services at the top level there in New York for the benefit of the whole, and especially of the million who don't know, would have to be linked directly to you so that your representatives from each state and province of North America could come down there and sit down with that board of trustees each year and act as a guide to them. People would be able to come home and say, yes, I've been there, I know, I have seen. It is worth the money, people. Let's support it. A cross-section of AA who could give this movement an opinion about itself, who could advise those trustees. In other words, somebody or something who could take the place of Dr. Bob and me. We realize now that you have grown up. You should come into possession of these assets. Your money, your book, your public relations, your principal newspaper, your office of mediation and propagation. These things should now be turned over to you. So Dr. Bob and I together prepared something we call the third legacy. The legacy of service in general, and in particular, the legacy of those services which cluster around the foundation of New York. And those services constitute your third legacy. And in the opening paragraphs of the third legacy pamphlet, which I expect not many of you have seen, Dr. Bob and I make you your bequest, and here it is. We, who are the older members of AA, bequeath to you, who are younger, these three legacies. 12 steps of recovery, the 12 traditions, and now the general services of Alcoholics Anonymous. Two of these legacies have long been in your keeping. By the 12 steps, we have recovered. By the 12 traditions, we have achieved a supreme unity. Being someday perishable, Dr. Bob and I now wish to deliver to the members of AA their third legacy. Since 1938, we and our friends have been holding it in trust. This legacy is the General Headquarters Services of Alcoholics Anonymous. The Foundation, the AA Book, the Grapevine, and the AA General Office. These are the principal services which have enabled our society to function and to grow. Acting on behalf of all, Dr. Bob and I ask that you, the members of AA, assume guidance of these services and guard them well. The future growth, perhaps the very survival of Alcoholics Anonymous, may one day depend on how prudently these arms of service are administered in the years to come. So there, my friends, is your third and last place. So with me, you must now see that our Cathedral of the Spirit is approaching completion. On its great floor, you and I can see and inscribe the 12 steps of recovery. Already 100,000 are standing there, and may they be joined by millions more. You and I have seen its side walls go up, now buttressed by our 12 steps of tradition, which we hope will contain this beloved society of ours in unity for so long as God may need it. And do you now not see that we are affixing the spire to this cathedral, and that the spire of our cathedral of the service of the Spirit will be named the Spire of Service, a beacon to the million who do not know. And may its symbolic finger ever point straight upward toward God.